So I chose it because even though my reasons for appreciating and being moved by it and being thrilled by it are always evolving, it works on two levels without fail. There's its aesthetic power, which is to me unimpeachable. Its style, the compositions, the narrative, this deep, brooding Gothic feel. It's arresting no matter how many times you've seen the film. But then there's its emotional undercurrent, which I think varies greatly depending on when you first encounter the film and what your frame of reference is as you continue to experience it. I first watched it when I was like maybe 13 years old. And it was on part of some, it was on TCM, on Turner Classic Movies, and part of some like Criterion Marathon or something. And I remember being deeply affected by the romance of the story and feeling really definitely that I wanted Joan Fontaine's character, the second Mrs. De Winter, to get her heart's desire. I wanted her to win, you know, to stay with Max and pull out all these older women who were trying so hard to like shame and abuse her and make her feel worthless. But then as you get older, even though the aesthetic pull of the film remains the same, the undertow changes. And you suddenly start wondering, well, wait a minute, what are the forces of good and evil actually at play here? And whom do I want to be the victor and why? So, yeah, that's why I chose it.
Welcome to Open Forum. I'm Michael Denzel Smith. The second Mrs. De Winter has no chance of living up to the legacy of the first. She didn't know that she would be asked to do so. She met Maxim De Winter on the French Riviera and married him after a whirlwind romance. But when they head to Manderley, Maxim's massive estate, the second Mrs. De Winter is confronted with the shadow of her predecessor, as well as the unraveling of the story of her death. This week's film is Rebecca, and it was chosen by Taya Obrick, author of the international bestsellers The Tiger's Wife and Inland. Yeah, there's that whole thing about who wins, right? Like, because the idea, the story about, what's his full name? Is it? It's George Fortescue.
George Fortescue Maximilian de Winter.
Yes, who? So really, I mean, rich people in names. Anyway, it's called Maxim throughout the film. You know, he is mourning the loss of his wife, we could say at this point, or that's what we sort of perceive that's happening at the beginning of the film. He meets this young woman who she's never given a name, is she?
No, she's not. She's in the book, she is a first person narrator and never named, and then in the film, she's always referred to as the second Mrs. De Winter.
Yeah, and he meets her, and you know, he's like, he's like vacationing, or just visiting. He's visiting a spot that was meaningful to him by virtue of this marriage to Rebecca De Winter. And he meets her. It's a whirlwind romance with this younger woman, immediately marries her, takes her to his huge estate. It's just grand palace. And the spirit of Rebecca De Winter, it's haunting the place. It's haunting every interaction between the two of them, between the new Mrs. De Winter and the staff that works there. Everything that's happening, every relationship, this is overcast on it. And there's a scene where he's saying, no, Rebecca has won. Rebecca won. And thinking about what you're saying and sort of like your initial reaction when you watch the film is to root for the new Mrs. De Winter to win. And I just feel like this parsing of these winners and losers here as relates to this story about like who needs to or who should come out on top.
Yeah, especially since the power dynamic that already exists in the film is so oppressive, right? And I think that when you're a very young person, you don't see that. You see this romance between an older, powerful, aristocratic man and this young woman who's sort of lifted out of her, you know, out of her distressing situation with this hilarious figure whose companion she is at the beginning.
Yeah.
And she's lifted out of it by this romance, and she's going to go and be the mistress of this great house, and it's a fairy tale, right? But the truth is that at the vortex of power in it is Maxim. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, Manderley is his ancestral home. Mm-hmm. It's this you know, opulent, extravagant estate where that, you know, sort of overlooks the whole county. And he is destined by forces of power and birth and British society to come out on top from the very, very beginning. And these women who come in, you know, whether it's Rebecca, who is sort of closer to him in rank, or the second Mrs. De Winter, who is not, they are pitted against each other in this sort of small chamber of power that they inhabit. But actually, his is the great, you know, he's at the top. He's the, the level boss of the film, certainly, which you don't know when you're a young person watching it, I think.
Yeah, and I get that impulse to root for her, really and truly, because, like, she arrives at Manderley and, you know, she's just, like, fallen quickly for this man, and that she's now whisked away to this place. She says it over and over again, like, I am not of this station. I don't know the rules and mores of this life. Like, I'm not accustomed to this social class and, like, how to operate. I don't know how to run a house, right? Like, I don't know what this means. And you see this, the... what's played is like naivete, but it's just being overwhelmed, right? Yeah. By these new responsibilities quickly shoved upon her. And you're like, no, you got this. You can do this. You can handle it. Because, you know, the woman that's been running the house, Mrs. Danvers, is like at her neck, basically. Yeah. It's just like, you're not going to live up to Rebecca De Winter ever. It's just not going to happen.
Totally. And it's interesting that you're talking about her sort of, her, you know, naivete, like, and her coming in and sort of admitting that she doesn't belong there, you know, becomes this running joke. Like, they keep referring to her as a child, mm-hmm. right? Like, he bosses her around and he has her, like, eat the eggs and, you know, put a coat on, you mustn't get cold. Like, he's very sort of paternal and patronizing toward her in their relationship. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a running joke in the family. Like, her sister, his sister refers to her as the child, you know? Mm-hmm. And this youth is actually is code for lack of sophistication. Mm-hmm. What they're really saying is, you're unsophisticated, and you, as you're saying, you can't do this. And she marries Maxim for love, and she's, I think, aware that she's in a really precarious position. And you know, Mrs. Van Hopper sort of trips her up at the beginning and tells her, you have no idea what it means to be a great lady.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, I think she tries to compensate for being overwhelmed by being very undemanding of the servants, like, very mm-hmm. equitable, and, like, sort of not trying to, you know, impose her will on them and boss them around the way Rebecca does. But she's too green to calculate that this could backfire, and it does.
Yeah.
And the servants, especially Mrs. Danvers, hate her for breaching this boundary between classes, going to this spot that she doesn't belong, you know, this line that's been drawn mm-hmm. between upstairs and downstairs. She's not somebody to them. She's not somebody who climbed, you know, the ranks to betterment, whatever that means, but she's just a usurper who doesn't know what she's doing. And she's upset the whole mm-hmm. structure for them. Especially Mrs. Danvers, who's like, you can't live up to that at all.
I didn't expect to see you, Mrs. Danvers. I noticed that a window wasn't closed, and I came up to see if I could fasten it.
Why did you say that? I closed it before I left the room. You opened it yourself, didn't you? You've always wanted to see this room, haven't you, madam? Why did you never ask me to show it to you? I was ready to show it to you every day. It's a lovely room, isn't it? Loveliest room you've ever seen. Everything is kept just as Mrs. De Winter liked it. Nothing has been altered since that last night. Come. I'll show you her dressing room.
Now, you mentioned her youth, and I guess, you know, obviously a Hitchcock film, it's all about sort of that psychological tension, and the parts that sort of start to make me feel that, and like it seems it's kind of a misdirection, I think, in a bit a way, but you know, Maxim is very moody, and there are reasons for that, obviously, that we can get into, but the things that make me start to like feel that tension and start to feel like something's wrong here. Something is very off about the way that he talks to her and the way that he's comporting himself is his obsession with her youth, right? Like in the way that he talks about it and in the way that he's almost dismissive of the idea of her as growing and changing, right? Like, they're in the car and they're having an argument, and then she says that she wishes she could be a 36-year-old with like a black satin dress and pearls and all of this. And he's like, if you were, you wouldn't be here, right? Like, or I wouldn't be with you, or, you know, something along those lines. And, you know, he calls her, yeah, the eggs thing. He's like, come on, eat up like a good girl. Like, and yeah, you're right. And sort of that paternal figure, but it's like, it's also that's the attraction, it seems, is like that he could, you know, capture her youth and, you know, entomb her in her youth.
Yeah. Oh, God, that's such a good way to put it. Yeah, absolutely. since everything else in the movie is a tomb, why can't her youth be her tomb? Yeah.
But it's just it's like the way that I was feeling was just I don't like to get into the conversations that happen around like age differences in relationships because to each their own, but except that like it became this the point of attraction for him,
yeah.
Right? And like and that means that there's an impossibility for her to ever change as a person, right? Like he rebuffs any of her attempts at like she tries to dress up like a woman like of aristocracy and he just kind of laughs at her
dress yeah. With that, you know, and the pearls yeah
totally. And he just laughs at her. He's like, what are you doing? Like how, like why are you doing any of this? And it, you know, you could read that in terms of him trying to make his own escape from it because like Rebecca De Winter embodied all of that. But it seems like he's not even trying to give her a chance to learn and grow into this role that he's thrust upon her.
Yeah, totally. And too, that he doesn't understand, like that he has absolutely no conception of, I mean, the way that isolation works in the film is really interesting, I think, particularly in how it relates to this. Because when it's just the two of them outside of Manderley, you know, that's her fantasy. Her fantasy is, I wish we could be in this moment forever. Before they start having that fight in the car, she's like, I'd like to capture, you know, like just to have a whole shelf of these moments as my memories, which is also impossible. So for her, there's this fantasy isolation in which the two of them exist just in this relationship, in this world together, in this moment before like Rebecca and Manderley and all these things that are going to come to doom her at the end. And for him, you know, that same desire is sort of centered on her youth.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the desire to preserve her as she is because he's already damned, you know, broodingly damned. But what happens is they come to the house and then there's this other, you know, the true isolation occurs because he isn't able to see that for, you know, the only choice she has is to grow, and he doesn't want this to happen. And he sort of, you know, he keeps leaving and sort of criticizing her, as you say, whenever he comes back and discovers that like she's attempted to change something about herself or bond with the house rather than stay in this glass jar of his memories.
Haven't you any family?
No, my mother died years and years ago, and then there was only my father, and he died last summer. And then I took this job.
How rotten for you.
Yes, it was rather, because, you see, we got on so well together.
You and your father?
Yes, he was a lovely person, very unusual.
What was he?
A painter.
Ah, was he a good one?
Well, I thought so, but people didn't understand him.
Okay, and so then there is Rebecca and her relationship to Maxim. And, you know, we're trudging along in the film, and we're sort of like slowly revealing some things here. And, you know, we're left to assume essentially that, like, or, you know, the story is that she was in a shipwreck, right? Like, she went out by herself in the sailboat, and that, you know, it capsized.
She was a great sailor.
She was a great sailor, but the boat capsized. She drowned. Later, her body was washed ashore. They found her. They buried her.
He identified her and everything. He went up. He identified her. It was deeply traumatic.
He identified her. another shipwreck happens. When he's married to the second Mrs. De Winter, he goes out and learns that they found Rebecca's boat, and they found her body inside. Right. And now he tells the truth. Like, we learn he's not just a man mourning the loss of his wife, right? That he tells the new Mrs. De Winter of the night that she died, and, you know, their in their actual relationship to one another. And, like, he hated her. They 4 days into their marriage, she's just broke down what it was actually going to be. She didn't love him. She was not, like, she would be the perfect wife, and she would turn Mandalay into this place that, like, the envy of all of the society folks, and you know, everyone would love this place. But she's going to be off doing her own thing. She had all of her different lovers, and she was just never going to pay any attention to Maxim.
Right.
And
all of which has the potential to be extremely embarrassing to his, like, you know, tight-lipped aristocratic state, right?
Yeah.
That's like the threat to his power, her sort of sexual liberation, or her openness about the fact that she's not going to be sitting at home darning his socks or whatever, is the great threat to his power, because people can find out that she's off in London, you know, having it off with any number of people, including her cousin, which is weird. But anyway,
so I wanted to get there, but since you brought it up, and it's not like some great analysis here, but the acceptance of the cousin fucking was just like I'm just like, wait, what, have I missed something?
Yeah, it was very, it was odd, and I think sort of was I think is the is like a tally in the bank of, well, like, Rebecca really was very depraved, you know, like she's which, you know, incest, not a great look. But I was really surprised at the end of the film when they're having the not to skip ahead, I won't reveal anything for the end yet, but when they're having the inquest, and the cousin sort of casually mentions, you know, you can tell everyone, he tells Mrs. Danvers, you can tell everyone that she was in love with me. Like, yeah. Nobody lets an eye.
No. You know? No. No one.
That's not the revelation, you know? Like, the revelation was she wasn't faithful to her husband, and isn't she was fucking her cousin, and that's very odd.
That's so weird. It's so weird. Maybe shit was just different in 1940, and there was just a lot of cousin fucking going on in England. But I just, I'm sorry. I was thrown off by that the entire time.
Fair, you know, just really, and the fact that everyone knew it, you know, and Mrs. Danvers knew it, and, like, that sort of didn't throw off her impression of Rebecca. And yeah, no, I of all the things that were allegedly damning about Rebecca that I sort of scoffed at, that was the only one where I kind of went,
That's Rebecca's one knock, as far as I'm concerned. and so to come back to the word knock, it is that, you know, he's basically embarrassed, right? Like, he is, like, And it's not that anyone has found out, but it's just living with the fact of her sexual liberation and her, like, you know, disinterest in him, that he's embarrassed constantly throughout the course of this marriage. And then what he says that he tells her that night, that she dies, is that, you know, she's pregnant. And that's the ultimate embarrassment here, is that then he would be in a position, if he never wants anyone to find out, of raising a child that he knows he did not father. And that, like, that's, he would have to walk through the world that way. And so he says, maybe I struck her. No, you hit her. Like, that's like not, let's not, like, you know, you're telling the story, tell the story. And then some course of accidents and, like, she's struck by something. She fell.
Right, she falls and hits her head on like an anchor that just happens to be sitting in the living room.
It's right there. And then she dies, and he can't get over the fact that, like, she was still smiling this entire time. So he tells this story, and young second Mrs. De Winter, still enamored with him, it's just like, no, you didn't kill her. I love you so much. We're going to... And I'm just like, stop. Stop.
Her, like, total Stockholm syndrome breakdown in that moment. Yeah. Where she's like, oh, God, you didn't love her. And she starts saying it, right? You didn't love her. You didn't love Rebecca. And that is her... That's her priority. Her priority in all this is, you know, isn't... This man has just admitted to, striking and leading directly to the death of his wife, whom he then stuffed in a boat, you know.
Stuffed in a boat.
Sailed out to sea and, like, and capsized and pretended to misidentify some random woman, you know. That none of that is of concern. What matters, the real revelation here, is that actually he never loved Rebecca. Yeah. And you know, you're not actually being haunted by the thing you think you're being haunted by. And this is sort of I think this is where the youth of a person really turns, because when I think when you're young, you really feel that, oh my goodness, thank God, you know.
Yeah.
He turns out that she is the villain that I have been feeling her to be, right? Like, Rebecca is the villain. Mm-hmm. She is the ghost in the hall. She is this oppressive house. She, you know, and everything's going to be all right. And then when you get a little older and you sit there and you're like, well, it's so horrifying to think that you are more afraid of the ghost of this older woman that you can't look up to than of your husband. Killed his previous wife in the room that you're sitting in and has just told you about it.
Yeah.
And this is what I mean about those sort of two levels. You know, it's a scary film. It's a moody, scary film no matter what, mm-hmm. but for different reasons as you go through life.
For different reasons, yeah, because you're saying that in terms of, like, the relation to it at different points of your life, and sort of, like, basically seeing the perspective shift from, you know, your age and, like, the perspective that you're associating with, right? And what I can say is that, like, look, in watching this film now, I'm like, no, Rebecca won and she should have won. But I can almost certainly see myself at some point, if I'd encountered this film earlier, watching it and going, oh man, Maxim was stuck in a loveless relationship. And just being like, oh man, I feel for that guy.
Totally. He was really in an impossible position, like having to raise the cousin's child, the cousin's child as his own, you know, in his big mansion, and pretend that you know this loveless union was something that it wasn't. Totally. And to some extent, I think it's why I think that Rebecca functions as a prototype for reckoning with Jane Eyre, or the Jane Eyre syndrome. You know what I mean? And you know, Jane Eyre is when you think about the similarities, you know, it's this story of a plain, poor English governess who steals the heart of brooding, mysterious English aristocrat, Mr. Rochester, right? And he's the master of Thornfield Hall, which is this dark and extravagant country estate, just like Manderley. And it turns out that his first wife, Bertha Mason, a woman of West Indian origin who is supposedly crazy, has been imprisoned in the attic upstairs for literally 15 or 20 years. And when you're young, you know, you're sort of weaned on Jane Eyre as this great story of female independence and overcoming class boundaries. But then, you know, you get a little older and you read The Wide Sargasso Sea by Jean Rhys, and it reexamines the story from the point of view of Bertha Mason and shows the role that power and colonialism play in how Bertha was perceived and treated and traumatized before being locked up in the attic. Wide Sargasso Sea was published in 1966. Rebecca, the novel, came out in 1938, and the Hitchcock adaptation followed in 1940. And so it's difficult not to see it as an attempt to contend with the question of like the myth and of the mysterious and insurmountable first wife, right? I think many of the same themes are present: this young, naive, materially disenfranchised woman, the cold, moneyed man with a tendency to brood on secrets, and all the secrets center on the existence of the previous wife, who's portrayed in the husband's eventual retelling of the story as sexually promiscuous and lewd and uncontrollable and a source of shame. And you know, it begs the question, what does the wife say in all this?
Yeah.
And Jean Rhys answers that question in Wide Sargasso Sea, but to some extent, I think Hitchcock's answer can't help but lie with Mrs. Danvers and this notion of victory. You know, I think she's the, I think Mrs. Danvers is kind of the lesbian feminist hero of the film, you know?
Yeah. yeah, for sure.
She's, you know, she's indisputably framed as the villain of the piece. Hitchcock shoots her as this menacing shadow, and she's a ghoul on the wall, and Judith Anderson plays her brilliantly with that completely wild and discomforting stare. But when she talks about Rebecca, she expresses admiration for what? For her late mistress's brains, her fearlessness, her independence, her irreverence. She knows all about Rebecca's sexual indiscretions, including the cousin fucking. But she isn't put off by any of them. She admires them. And she says that, you know, love was a game to Rebecca and that she would laugh at everybody. Yeah. And she would tell Danvers everything. And she uses Danvers' name as her, you know, as her secret name when she goes to the doctor. And Danvers is the guardian of Rebecca's shrine and mausoleum, you know, which she's ensured that all of Manderley has become. And she believes that nobody, man or woman, ever got the better of Rebecca. And that in the end, it was the sea. And you have to wonder, you know, when she burns the place down, that's sort of still the case. Rebecca totally, totally wins.
Yes.
New York or Manderley?
Oh, please don't joke about it. Mrs. Van Harper's waiting, and I'd better say goodbye now.
I repeat what I said. Either you go to America with Mrs. Van Hopper or you come home to Manderley with me.
You mean you want a secretary or something?
I'm asking you to marry me, you little fool.
Mrs. Danvers is holding the place of the older woman here that, like, we've lost with Rebecca in terms of, like, her physical presence. And checking this younger woman first and saying, look, you don't belong here. And, like, yes, you would... If you're looking just from sort of just from perspective, you're like, well, no, why would you cast out this poor young woman who's just trying to love this man and like now has the access to all of this life and what have you? But it's as if Mrs. Danvers knows that there's something afoot with Maxim and like his relationship to Rebecca, and she can't say it because of her own class position, right?
Right.
And that, you know, she clearly is very in love with Rebecca De Winter, right? Like, there's a tenderness and affection for her that, you know, I think is probably the one true love in all of this film, except maybe the cousin's love for Rebecca, who knows? but when she, and I'm, you know, my podcast, I can do spoilers. She burns down Manderley. And it's just like everything you were we were talking earlier about being entombed. Everything that's entombed there is now cast aside, and it is all of the secrets. It is all of the pressures. It is all of the disrespect, and it is all of the things that, like, it feels like Rebecca is, in the way she's described, you know, pushing against, right? Like, it's not as if she doesn't know that there's the potential within these types of marriages and these arrangements to be completely loveless. And she's sort of accepting that her station will, like, that's something that's, you know, expected of her. And it's, and she's saying outright, she's claiming her own space to say, look, I'm not going to live that way. And I know that I'm not attracted to you. I'm never going to love you, Maxim. And I'm going to live free. And she does that to knowing the risk therein and the consequences that that could have for him and for her. And she does ultimately pay that price, but she pays the price in, like, this way that, you know, we're led to believe is basically her attempt at suicide because she learns that she has cancer. But even then, she's just saying, like, look, I know the ins and outs of these relationships, and I know that saying this thing, like, I don't want to live with cancer. I know that if I say this thing to my husband, I know exactly the reaction that will come about. Like, she, it's like Rebecca's the smartest one here in that she understands all of the power dynamics, all of the gender dynamics, and she's both, you know, flaunting them and flouting them in her life, and then in her death, she's exploiting them.
Totally, totally, absolutely. That's such a good, and you know, and tormenting him from beyond the grave. She's at rest, but he's not. Yeah.
Teo, what's one lasting image that sticks with you from Rebecca?
For me, it's the scene when Mrs. Danvers comes through the curtains in Rebecca's room in the West Wing the first time that the second Mrs. De Winter, the first time that the second Mrs. De Winter goes up into Rebecca's room in the West Wing, which she's dreaded for so long, and Mrs. Danvers comes through the curtains in silhouette. Yeah, and he always shoots her in silhouette. She's usually the shadow, and she's a shadow at the very end, like when he focuses in on her through the burning window. But that moment, I think, has always haunted me, and I think it's one of the ones that is often used too. You know, like when you see that moment in a montage of old movie, that's Rebecca. Yeah. How about you?
Of the images, I mean, it's so vast and so grand. I mean, it really is just when they approach Manderley, and it's sort of like, you know, we talked about sort of that Gothic imagery, and it's just like, this, there's no way that this place isn't haunted, right? Like, it's just so, it's too grand for the number of people that live there, right? And just the amount of open space that's always around you. Like, there's no sense that, like, you could ever truly be alone, but you feel your tininess and you feel a loneliness being in that space. And so once you get that very first shot of it, it's just like then understanding that there's nothing here that could ever, to me, foster anything but this emotional turmoil.
Yeah, I love that. That's so... Oh, let's do that. That's so true. Absolutely. Yeah.
Teo, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. This is so much fun.
Thanks for listening to Open Forum, a podcast from Lit Hub Radio, produced by Justin Alvarez and hosted by me, Michael Denzel Smith. Feel free to like, comment, and subscribe to Open Forum wherever you get your podcasts, and or sign up for the Lit Hub newsletter to stay up to date on our latest episode. Next week, Richard Kimball didn't kill his wife, and Samuel Gerard doesn't care.